And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Marcus Allen is the British distributor and publisher of the UK edition of Nexus magazine. Nexus, of course, deals with news and information that is overlooked, underreported, ignored by the mainstream media. Subjects covered include hidden history, future science, alternative health issues, conspiracies, and yes, UFOs. And like many others, Marcus watched the Apollo moon landings live on television, and at that time applauded the evident success of those missions. After attending a lecture 10 years ago which questioned the validity of the moon landings, he decided to carry out his own research. Having worked as a photographer in London in the 1960s, Marcus was able to examine the well-known photographs issued by NASA from a professional viewpoint. He has also researched many other aspects of Apollo. He has given many public presentations on this subject, during which he always asks for someone to prove him wrong. To date, he says no one has. He has reluctantly come to the conclusion that it is beyond reasonable doubt some manipulation of the Apollo record has taken place. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Marcus, welcome to the program. How are things in England, my friend?
Thank you, George. It's just dawning in England at the moment.
Excellent.
So we're a wee bit ahead of you, so I can tell you that tomorrow will happen.
Well, I hope so, because they keep talking about England would be the first to get involved in this possible new ice age one day, and I hope that never occurs out there.
Well, it's an interesting subject, that one, all to do with the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to get you back one day for another show on that. And so tell me, you went to a lecture 10 years ago, and is that what kind of got you fascinated about this Apollo landing or not?
Yeah, it was. About 10 years ago, it was actually an American who was giving the lecture, which was what was so interesting. David Childress of Adventures Unlimited.
Oh, yes. No, David.
Yeah, he's well known. And he was showing some slides and put some photographs up, which pictures that most people are very familiar with, the Apollo 11 landings. And he pointed out a few things about them, and I thought, hey, that's interesting. Now, at that time, I was a photographer. I'd used the equipment that was used on, similar equipment to the one used on Apollo, the Hasselblad cameras, and I thought, I'm going to have a look at this. I'm going to find out if what he's talking about has got any validity, any truth in it. And the more I looked, the more I found that there were significant problems with it. I say quite openly, I say that there are three things I believe in: Father Christmas, the Tooth Fairy, and God.
Mm-hmm.
For everything else, I want evidence.
Sure.
So let's have a look for the evidence. And the more I looked, the more I found questions, not confirmation, which is what I was looking for. I thought, you know, like you say, I watched the Apollo moon landings. I watched them live. I was living in London at the time. And I stayed up. It happened at 3 o'clock in the morning.
For you, yeah. That's right, yeah.
For us, I'd been up all night, and I thought, I've got to watch this. This is history. I want to be a part of it. And I was blown away by it. I thought, this is fantastic. Like half the world's population, we watched it, and we really did believe that what we were watching was the truth, the pure, unadulterated truth. It was on the television, wasn't it? It was live from the moon. That's what it said. We believed it. And it was then, like 10 years ago, that I started saying, well, was it live? You played that very famous sequence.
Absolutely.
Of the,
I mean,
landing.
It was chilling for me, Marcus, to hear it again.
I know. I mean, we were on the edge of our seat. It was better than any thriller. It was an extraordinary moment. Man's on the moon. I remember looking out of the window and thinking, there's a man on the moon. This is great. This is fantastic. Man can do anything. And also, remember at the time, we're talking 1969, July 1969, over in the UK, Concorde was just becoming well known. It was just
beginning
to fly. I mean, these were wonderful days.
It might have been, at least in our immediate history, one of the most glorious days for humankind. I think, if I remember, I was 19 years old. It was euphoric that day. I mean, the people were happy. They were friendly. I mean, it was an incredible moment.
It was. It was. It was the first real event that everybody in the world could understand, take part in, and feel a part of. It was the first event that really did bring people together. And as you say, people were euphoric. People were excited. It was science in action.
Now, I'm going to ask you the big question now, and then we're going to back into this. Do you believe that we, as people, not just Americans, but as people, that we went to the moon? Or do you believe that we did not go and fudge the photographs? Or do you also believe maybe we did go, but we altered the photographs for other purposes?
That's a very good point. I would like to be able to argue that somebody has been to the moon. Because getting to the moon wasn't really a problem. Even back then, it wasn't really a problem. The rockets were certainly powerful enough to get there. The ability to direct craft towards the moon rather than somewhere else was certainly available. To get to the moon wasn't a problem. The real problem was getting back. That's the key. Getting there isn't a problem. Getting back was the real difficult part.
Why? Because, you know, we saw the lunar module, the LEM, I guess, blast off from the moon, and it successfully attached itself to the command capsule, and off they went back to Mother Earth. Why would it be so difficult?
The sheer ability to do so. Now, let's just have a look at it. Okay, when you're going to the moon, basically you can see where you're going from the moment you leave. It's like sailing a boat on an ocean. If you can see where you're going, you just point towards it, and the tides may take you a bit up and down. But
you'll get there eventually, yeah.
You can see where you're going.
Yeah.
Coming back, yes, the Earth is a big thing, but the Earth is very dangerous from the point of view of man trying to get onto it if he's coming from outside the Earth. What he has to do is to enter the Earth's atmosphere at a very precise angle and at a very precise speed. Now, he can control the angle, but the speed is something which is dictated by gravity. The gravitational attraction of the Earth is very powerful compared to the Moon.
True.
As a spacecraft comes towards the Earth, or as anything comes towards the Earth, it is attracted with increasing speed towards it.
Now,
because of gravity.
Okay, are you saying, because this is an important point here, are you saying that this approach from the moon to the Earth was so much more dangerous than, let's say, our Gemini missions, when we were just orbiting the planet and then coming back in through the atmosphere?
Exactly.
Okay.
Much, much more difficult. Now, if you're in Gemini or Mercury, or if you're in the space shuttle, or if you're in Mir, or if you're in any of the Russian craft, the Soyuz craft, if you're in orbit around Earth, your orbit speed is about 17,500 miles an hour. All right, very fast, but nowhere near as fast as the speed you would approach Earth from outside, i.e. from the moon.
Okay.
You're approaching Earth at the speed you leave it, 25,000 miles an hour. And spacecraft don't have brakes. All right, they have rockets to direct their angle
a little
of approach.
Sure.
But they don't have brakes. You can't say, whoops, start again, go around one more time and come in. No, you have one hit at it, and that's it. Now, as you approach the Earth, you have to hit it at a certain angle. If you hit it at too shallow an angle, because you're going so fast, you will literally bounce off the atmosphere and go into orbit around the sun.
And it's history time then.
Definitely history. If you come in at too steep an angle, you will burn up.
And ultimately,
as we saw very tragically a couple of years ago.
Exactly. And then disintegrate.
And then, yes. And you don't get a second chance. So this envelope, if you like, this little entry point for a craft approaching the Earth from outside the atmosphere, from outside orbit, from the moon, is an envelope 40 miles wide and about 6 miles high. You have to enter it at a very precise angle on the Earth's atmosphere, and then the craft is designed to absorb the heat of the friction of the atmosphere, and that's where you get the heat shields on spacecraft to absorb this heat. It will absorb sufficient heat to slow the craft down, and then the parachutes can be deployed. Now, if you can imagine, you're standing on top of the Empire State Building, and I'm standing at the bottom with a beer glass. You're standing on top with a marble, 1 inch in diameter. I'm standing at the bottom with my beer glass 3 inches in diameter, I have to catch the marble you drop from the top of the Empire State Building in my beer mug 6 times without missing once.
Well, chances are you probably wouldn't even see it.
Exactly. That is the accuracy with which the spacecraft has to enter the Earth's atmosphere, or it bounces off or burns up.
However, if that model had my mathematics behind it and had little tiny rockets on it and everything else that went along with the capsule that re-entered, couldn't I have found my way, assuming I was in the similar kind of situation, couldn't I have found my way into your beer glass?
You could have done if you could have steered the craft, if you could have maneuvered the craft, if you had rockets that were, or maneuvering systems that could bring it in. It's like a plane landing on an aircraft carrier at sea. The plane has to line itself up because it can see it all the time. If the plane gets the angle of approach wrong onto an aircraft carrier, it can take off and go around again and try one more time.
Sure.
With a spacecraft, you can't do that. You can't go around one more time.
No, you get one shot, that's it.
You get one shot, and then you've got to come in, and you've got to make sure you get everything right. And you don't have the option of maneuvering. You have to line it up. And if you recall on Apollo 13, the famous time where they didn't land on the moon mm-hmm. because of problems on the craft, the craft was lined up by eye. They literally looked out of the window and lined up the Earth coming back. And this seems a bit unlikely given the actual accuracy required for re-entry.
Well, now, do you have... It's going to be a fascinating night with you tonight, Marcus, because, you know, I've always believed that we landed on the moon, and you're going to have to convince me otherwise, I think, by the end of tonight. But I'm open to talking with you about it. I don't think anything's preposterous, I think, but at the same time, you know, there's some things that I've always believed. Now, you may say to me, what proof do you have, George? I don't have any. I mean, I'm going on faith, and you know, same with the rocket, the rocks. We have moon rocks,
sure.
But if you were to ask me if I've ever seen them, no. And how would I know they came from the moon? I wouldn't. That's what they told me.
Exactly.
But I mean, are you basing a lot of this then on the fact that we had so many successful re-entries with Apollo?
We have 8 successful re-entries on Apollo. Apollo 8 didn't land on the moon. Apollo 9 didn't go to the moon. It was in Earth orbit. Apollo 10 didn't land on the moon but re-entered Earth. Apollo 13 didn't land on the moon but came back and re-entered. The others all landed. That's Apollo 11, 12, 14, and so on. So there were 9 missions that went out beyond Earth orbit. And this is the key to it. Everything in space that we read about today, the space shuttle, the space station, the Hubble Space Telescope, everything occurs in low Earth orbit.
True.
This is about 250 miles up.
Okay.
Not very far, about the distance between Washington and New York. Not very far in terms of space. It's quite a long way in terms of man. In Earth, low Earth orbit, in the space station, the space shuttle, everything happens below what are called the Van Allen radiation belts.
Okay.
Named after Professor James Van Allen, who was the first man to identify them precisely in 1958. The Van Allen radiation belts are the safety net around Earth. They are basically belts of radiation held in place by the Earth's magnetic field. The Earth has a pretty strong magnetic field, and these belts of radiation, the radiation in turn is generated by the sun, as all energy is generated that we use on Earth by the sun. This radiation, parts of it, are extremely dangerous to man. We basically couldn't survive. You recall hearing about these holes in the ozone layer above the Arctic and the Antarctic?
Sure.
And how if they get any bigger, the radiation will get through, we'll all get cancer and die. This is dangerous stuff, this radiation, so we need protection. Now, without getting into the rights and wrongs of holes in the ozone layer, all it tells us is that radiation from the sun is not only dangerous, it's very helpful to us on Earth. We need it, but we only need it. We only need certain parts of it. The dangerous parts we could do without, and fortunately the Earth is designed in such a way that allows the radiation to, the helpful radiation to come through and the good and the bad radiation not. Now, it's equivalent of you going out in a rainstorm. Now, if you don't have an umbrella, you're going to get wet.
You're going to get soaked.
You're going to get soaked. If you have an umbrella, you can protect yourself against pretty well all rainstorms, except possibly a tropical monsoon.
Correct.
But then it's not so cold.
Which
so
will then
really
fold your umbrella inside out, probably.
You've got a problem. So if you imagine the Van Allen radiation belts are the umbrella against the radiation generated by the sun. So the radiation would be the rain, the Van Allen radiation belts would be the umbrella, and you would be the Earth. As long as you stay under your umbrella, you're going to stay moderately dry. If you go outside your umbrella, if you go outside the Van Allen radiation belts, you're exposed to radiation.
Well, what if your capsule has then become an umbrella?
The capsule would be an umbrella, and if it was light drizzle, the capsule would be quite acceptable and good protection. If the radiation is in the form of a tropical storm, the capsule may not be sufficient. Now, what you've got to look at is the intensity of the radiation. From background radiation, which could be a light drizzle, to tropical radiation, which could be a tropical storm, which could be the severe levels of radiation that we know are lethal to man.
All right, stay with us, Marcus. We're going to take this quick break. We'll be back. I want to continue talking about the Van Allen radiation belt, and then also we'll get into some of these photographs as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Marcus Allen. He is the distributor, publisher of the United Kingdom's edition of Nexus Magazine, his website, nexusmagazine.com. Marcus, let's pick up again with the radiation belt, and then we'll get into some of these photographs that were allegedly taken of the moon. And I'll ask you shortly if you think we did go to the moon or not. But go ahead. Now let's pick it up with the Van Allen belt again.
Okay, the Van Allen belts, these are belts of intense radiation, concentrated radiation. And virtually anybody you speak to will tell you that if you're going to go through them, you've got to go through them pretty fast. And certainly the Saturn V rocket going to the moon, allegedly, went through them very fast, 25,000 miles an hour. It would have spent about an hour and a half, 2 hours going through these belts. And we're told that this is quite acceptable and there wouldn't be sufficient exposure to dangers for any astronauts in these radiation belts. And once they're out the other side, of course, no problem, bright sunlit uplands, and we can just cruise our way to the moon and everything's going to be jolly. Well, that's what we've been asked to believe. The trouble is, that isn't actually as simple as it sounds. Because these belts of radiation, as ask any scientist who has examined them and done experiments with them, and to be fair, there aren't many people who can answer with a degree of first-hand knowledge, because it's very hard to get information about the levels of radiation and the exposure that they will have on man.
But can you imagine the secret that they would have to have kept with all those hundreds of thousands of employees and technicians and astronauts to keep quiet for so many years?
Oh, I can. I think at the height of the Apollo program in the mid-1960s, there were upwards of 400,000 people working directly on parts of the program.
And to
I mean, these people were based right across America, from Oregon to Florida, from California to Washington.
But, you know, what the whistleblowers, Marcus, are everywhere. I mean, the CIA can't have a document without it getting into the media, or getting in our hands. To my knowledge, not one Apollo employee has come forward to say, this is a hoax, I worked there, here are my credentials. I don't know of any, do you?
There are some, yes, there are some. Now, it's a question that I get asked many times. As you said in the introduction, I do public presentations in the UK on this subject. And this is the question I'm virtually guaranteed to be asked. Why didn't anybody blow the whistle? And, in fact, there's a follow-up question to that as well. We'll come to it in a minute. Most of the people who were working on Apollo, in fact, virtually everybody working on Apollo, were doing the very best job they could. They were designing the best rockets they could, the best control panels, control centers. They were doing the job that they were asked to do. They weren't questioning it. They were like you and like me at the time and like virtually everybody else who was alive at that time and aware of what was going on. We wanted it to happen. We were saying, go for it, go for it, get on with it, do it, get there. We wanted this to be successful. You've got to look at Apollo in the context of its times. This is the mid to late 1960s. What else was going on at that time? There was the Vietnam War. It was turning very nasty. Mm-hmm. There was the space race. The Russians had beaten America into virtually every space first.
We were in the midst, in the early 60s, of the Cuban Missile Crisis, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That had shaken everybody. I was aware very much of that happening at the time. We genuinely thought the world was about to end. I mean, it's very hard to grasp today with the knowledge that we have of what did happen at that time, exactly how dangerous we felt the situation was. And it was a very dangerous situation. So there was a great deal of fear. There was a great deal of unhappiness. And we wanted to believe that our governments were telling us the truth. President Kennedy, in the early 1960s, he was the man who faced down Khrushchev.
Absolutely.
He was the man who had issued the famous challenge. We will land a man on the moon before the decade is out and return him safely to the Earth. This was a fantastic challenge for the American people, for the people of the world. All right, it was the American people who did it, and the rest of the world, us, we were standing there clapping and cheering and saying, go for it, get it, score the goal.
Of course.
And we wanted this to happen. Now, the Vietnam War comes along, very unpleasant. The space race has been going on throughout the 1960s, and to be fair, America don't have the option of coming second to anybody.
True.
Especially the Russians.
And we're in this Cold War.
We're in the Cold War. It's very, very nasty. We're on the side of the good guys, and we don't want the bad guys to win. It's pretty simple compared to what we have today. So looking at it in the context of the time, yes, we wanted it to succeed. Yes, there were 400,000 people, plus probably a million of their families, people directly connected with employees at all the major companies working to produce parts of Apollo. All this was going on, and everybody wanted it to succeed. Now, it's only, as I say, I first heard about it only 10 years ago. This is in the 1990s. Nobody questioned it, though I do recall at the time there were people who doubted that what they were watching was anything other than a rather poorly designed Hollywood film set.
Well, now, let me ask you this, though, Marcus. If you're correct, and we did not go to the moon, I'll play the devil's advocate here for a moment.
Okay.
Then what was the purpose of this? Was it to create jobs? Was it to spend money? Was it a PR campaign to scare the Soviets at the time? That we could do it, you can't, you better stay away. Therefore, our missiles may be better than yours. What was the reason for the illusion?
It was primarily to... It was basically propaganda. As I say, it was necessary for America to demonstrate its technological superiority over the Soviet Union. In doing so, the rest of the world, the spectators cheering around the edges, if you like, could be persuaded that the American ability and belief and open society that was quite evident was the more successful and should be supported. It was also a diversionary factor. We mentioned the Vietnam War. This was not a very pleasant experience for anybody who'd lived through it. There were a considerable amount of protests going on. If you remember, the Tet Offensive in 1968 had really brought it into our living rooms at the time. We watched it as you watched it. there were things needed. Now, it sounds very cynical to say that the Apollo program was just a diversionary factor from other far more unpleasant things going on. But what other purpose did it have? It was initiated by John Kennedy, President Kennedy, but at the time he issued his challenge in 1961, it was May 1961 in his address to the Joint Houses of Congress, no American had been into space. This is Alan Shepard had been up for about 100 miles and come straight down again. John Glenn wasn't to orbit the Earth until the following year, 1962.
And he went around, what, three times, something like that?
Three times.
Yeah.
But Yuri Gagarin had already been up and orbited. So it was necessary for America to take up the challenge and be seen to succeed. Now, at some point, a decision would have to have been made. Can we actually land a man on the moon? Now, don't forget, at this point, President Kennedy had been assassinated in November 1963.
Sure. Now, were we truly attempting to go to the moon?
Oh, definitely attempting to go to the moon. Absolutely.
Right.
No dispute, no doubt whatsoever about that. The rockets were designed to do exactly that. They had to lift a 50-ton payload, not into Earth orbit, but into moon orbit. They were big enough. Anybody who's seen the pictures and the films of the Saturn V rockets taking off, which in fact are very similar in power and visual drama to the space shuttle taking off today, those were real rockets. There were real astronauts on top of them. Everything that was made for the Apollo program was real.
Well, when these astronauts were launched, where did they end up going if they didn't go to the moon?
Okay. We have two options here. The worst-case scenario is that at some point somebody decided it's going to be far too dangerous to send real live men out into space where we don't know what's going to happen to them. Let's put them into Earth orbit, keep them in Earth orbit.
Which we've demonstrated we can do, right?
Oh, we can do that quite easily.
Yeah.
The Mercury and Gemini craft had demonstrated Earth orbit was not a dangerous place, relatively speaking.
True.
So the worst-case scenario is launch the Saturn V rocket, live on television, as we all saw. 2 minutes after launch, it disappears into space, and now we have to rely on NASA to tell us what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The astronauts go into Earth orbit and stay there. And then after the elapsed time of the mission, whether it's 8 days for Apollo 11 or 12 days for Apollo 17, they come back down into the Pacific on their parachutes live on television. And so we can see the beginning and the end. In the middle, we're told everything that's going on by NASA. They had already done a great deal of training and simulation. They had done real-time simulation exercises. If it was an 8-day mission, they did an 8-day simulation.
Right.
These simulations
which was smart to do, right?
You would expect it.
Yeah.
And there were simulation sets. These were not secret at all. A lot of people knew about it. A lot of people were filming them. There were about 5 major sets right across America.
I think Cronkite used to go to those every once in a while during the coverage to say, you know, let's go to a simulator. Let's take a look at this or that.
Sure. Yep.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't Wally Schirra sitting next to him on some of these productions? And they went to a simulator, and you could see what was going to be happening on the moon.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. And they designed it as realistically as possible. I mean, I have photographs. I have the research I've done has turned up some very interesting photographs.
Okay, well, you won't get an argument from me that we didn't have those sets. I believe we did too.
Absolutely,
okay.
And they were very realistic.
Yes.
Now, this is a worst case scenario. They've gone into Earth orbit and stayed there.
Yep.
And everything that we have seen demonstrating the landing on the moon was filmed during the simulation exercises, and the photographs were taken by good professional photographers employed by NASA. These were all part of the PR exercise to demonstrate to the American people that the $40 billion that Apollo ultimately cost had been well spent. And we were persuaded. I was persuaded. I'm sure you were. I'm sure many people listening were persuaded that the Apollo missions were successful. Now, that's the worst-case scenario. The best-case scenario is that they were launched exactly as we saw. They went into Earth orbit, as we knew they would do, for a couple of orbits, and then they launch for the moon. They get to the moon, they get out, they take the photographs that we've subsequently seen, walk around a bit, get back in their lunar lander, go back into moon orbit, come back to the Earth, land successfully, as we all watched on television.
Sure.
Then they go and develop the photographs. Oh, dear. They're all fogged.
They're all fogged.
They're totally
all...
useless. We can't use them.
Right.
At that time, if you recall, everybody, every magazine, Life magazine, Look magazine, all the major magazines, National Geographic, they all wanted these famous moon photographs.
I would agree with this. This is a strong possibility.
So, the photographs that were taken by the real astronauts on the moon are totally useless and cannot possibly be used. Somebody at that point might have said, okay, now, remember those ones we did on the simulation exercise? We could use those.
Yeah, they'll say, well, who would know the difference? So
who would know the difference? Nobody else has been to the moon. So that's what they did.
All right, and let me add a third caveat to this, then to get your take, and then we'll try to fill in the gaps here on how this may have been done. They go to the moon. We launch for the moon. They land on the moon. And all of a sudden, oh, my God, they see extraterrestrial spaceships there. They see things that they didn't want us to know about, maybe ancient artifacts on the moon, who knows what. And they were so prevalent that the photographs that they did take, they couldn't show us. And so when they were done with their mission, they came back and also said, we better show some recreated pictures because we're not showing the ones we took. Is that possible?
Absolutely. Of course that's possible. That's a very, very real possibility. And in fact, it's probably the most frightening of them all.
Yes.
Because in two aspects. One is that if there is evidence of intelligent life having been on the moon at some point, it may not be there right now, but it would have demonstrated that some intelligent life had been onto the moon at some early point in our history.
There was always talk, Marcus, that Neil Armstrong looked across a crater and saw a huge object. And, I mean, I remember seeing and reading about things like that, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I've heard the story. In fact, I've heard somebody who was allegedly in the next-door hotel room to Neil Armstrong in Rome when he apparently said this. Now, there's a very interesting point about this. It's a very plausible explanation for why the Apollo photographs have been manipulated. Now, one has to take into account one other factor.
And that is?
Disinformation.
True. Absolutely true. And we've seen what governments can do with disinformation.
I mean, one only has to ask the question, do you believe everything your government tells you about everything all the time? And if the answer to that is no, where do you draw the line?
True.
Where do you say, I believe that, but I'm not sure about that?
And if you say yes, I think you're being pretty darn naive.
I think we've had pretty good demonstrations of that recently, but let's not get into that one. Now, if the story, this famous story of Neil Armstrong saying, they're over there, they're huge, they're looking at us type of thing, is true, then because he said it when he was on the moon, the reasonable assumption is that the transmission in which he said it is recorded, as all transmissions were. You played one of the ones right at the beginning of the show. I've never heard that transmission. I've only seen transcripts, alleged transcripts of it. Now, the explanation could be, well, of course you couldn't have it as a real transmission. It was a secret transmission on a secret frequency that couldn't be picked up by ham radio operators.
That's true.
All I want to hear is anybody who has a recording that can be identified as being of the time and said by Neil Armstrong saying those things. Because my view is, and I suppose one could say it's a little bit cynical, is that this story about artifacts on the moon could be partially disinformation to persuade us that Neil Armstrong got to the moon in the first place to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Could be one explanation.
I see what you mean.
And the other explanation is that I know that Richard Hoagland is very enthusiastic about the idea of artifacts on the moon, and I've seen a lot of his presentations and his talks, and the evidence he comes up with is very persuasive.
True. Well, he pushes primarily Mars, but I do believe he also believes there's something going on the moon.
That's right, and he is obviously not going to be particularly enthusiastic about the idea that we didn't get there in the first place, because then his ideas wouldn't necessarily be particularly persuasive in themselves.
Marcus, stay with us. We've got two more hours to go with you, and we're wrapping up our first. We'll be back in a moment as we talk then about some of this photographic evidence. Compelling. And maybe they did alter some of the photographs and change them. But then there was a reason for that. And welcome back to Coast, Marcus Allen, our guest. Marcus, earlier last hour I asked you why haven't we had any whistleblowers at all, and you said, well, there are some. Who are they? Who are these people?
These are people who've worked in NASA, worked in the organization. They're people who have come forward with pieces of information that needs to be examined. But primarily, we don't want to hear that news. We don't want to believe that the Apollo program was in some way manipulated.
I mean, have they come forward publicly? Because I can't find them.
They haven't come forward publicly insofar as...
their names and who they
are. John Doe hasn't stood up and said, I was in the control room during Apollo X, and I know perfectly well that we were playing tapes
right,
of the simulation mission. Nobody said that because, to be honest, he wouldn't be alive 10 minutes later. He'd get lynched because people don't want to believe it. So the whistleblowers, there are one or two more public ones, but most of them have said, okay, I don't think that everything that you've heard about Apollo was as accurate as it should have been. I suggest you examine the record. And what has happened is that people outside NASA have taken up that challenge and have examined the Apollo record, which is easily available. NASA were particularly keen to ensure that everybody got to see it. It's when you start to examine it, as I have done, I mean, you could say that I'm a whistleblower. I didn't work for NASA. To be honest, I've never visited America. Maybe I'm not going to be allowed to. I don't know. I hope I will be. I'd love to come.
Well, it's a wonderful country. You should be.
I have heard, and the people are particularly nice. The Americans I've met over in Britain here are without doubt the most friendly, open, generous people as a race that I've met.
Yep.
So from that point of view, I have no problem with American people in any way, shape, or form.
And we don't get much credit worldwide, Marcus, but that's another story all by itself.
Well, this goes back. I mean, we're with you on that, because don't forget, Britain had an empire that we got beaten over the head about for years, and we're still getting beaten over the head about it. But you speak to many people who were allegedly under the British yoke or the rule, and they will say it's the best thing that ever happened to us, but they're not going to say it too publicly.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
anyway,
back to this.
Back to this. What we've got to look at is whether, if there aren't whistleblowers, that doesn't mean to say that there's nothing wrong. There have been whistleblowers. There have been people who've got up and said, not everything that you've heard about Apollo is 100% true. Other people, such as myself, David Percy, who is a friend of mine, has done a lot of research into this area. People who have looked into it have concluded that at the very least, the Apollo record has been manipulated. Now, in what way it's been manipulated is a matter of debate. And
well,
there are people...
and I won't doubt that. I mean, I've looked at over the last few years and most recently today some of these photographs, and I do have to say some of them do look manipulated or changed. To me, it doesn't mean or prove we didn't go.
Absolutely.
Because I also like your theory, your possibility that they went, came back, and had no photographs. And they went, oh, my God, now what are we going to do?
Yeah.
You can't go back again, at least at that point.
Well, technically you could, because let's assume that the first mission that landed, we're told, was Apollo 11, which was the most famous one because it was the first one.
Sure.
And there were five others after that. So, yes, they did go back.
Well, that's true. And I don't think all the photographs were botched, were they? Or maybe it was inherent with the camera.
Well, I think the camera is the key to this, and maybe we should just take a few minutes just to look at what the camera was about, because the camera produced the photographs.
Okay.
Now,
what kind of cameras did they use?
Right. It was they all used the same camera. This was the camera that was used on the lunar surface to take photographs of the astronauts, the ones we're all familiar with. They were all Hasselblad cameras. Now, Hasselblad is a camera made in Sweden, but it happens to be the best camera you can buy.
Now, were they made especially for the moon flight, or were they the same cameras that you would use on the planet here?
They're very similar to the one you could go into a shop today and buy. You could go into a shop today and buy a similar camera. It's the Hasselblad 500. It was such a good camera, they haven't really changed the design of it much since it was first produced. It was altered because there were various things that needed to be changed on the camera, and these were done by Hasselblad in Sweden. The most important thing was there's no viewfinder, because you couldn't use it. If you were in a spacesuit, you couldn't get your head close enough to the viewfinder.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's on top of the camera. So there was no viewfinder, and they wanted to remove the mirror, which is it's a single-lens reflex camera. They removed the mirror from inside. It was a motor drive camera, i.e. the film was advanced automatically. As soon as you'd taken a picture, the film advanced automatically using an electric, a couple of batteries and a motor. It had no exposure meter built in. Hasselblad cameras do not have exposure meters built in. It was manually operated in the focusing, setting of the shutter speed, 1/60th, 25th, 250th.
Mm-hmm.
It was also manually operated in setting the aperture, f5.6, f8, f11. All these were manual operation, and the shutter button is on the front of the camera. So when the camera is mounted on an astronaut's chest, as they all were, he couldn't see where the shutter button was.
He'd have to feel around for it, I guess. And how do you do that with those big gloves on, right?
Well, you're wearing armored gauntlets, so you're not going to feel a lot through them. You also have no means of knowing if you've actually taken a photograph. Have you pressed the shutter, or did you miss and press a bit of the camera? Because the only means of knowing if you've taken a photograph on the special lunar Hasselblads, the moon cameras, was a little dial on the side of the camera indicating if the film had advanced.
Well,
now,
when you take a photograph,
you'd press the shutter, and you hear a click, and you know you've taken a picture.
Right.
And most people are familiar with cameras. Now, in space, you won't hear the click because sound doesn't travel in a vacuum, which is what the moon is. So you have this problem. You've got a camera that has no viewfinder, has no exposure meter. You have to estimate the light, which nobody's been to the moon before to take photographs, so nobody knows how bright the light is. We know it's pretty bright up there. All we do know is there are no clouds, so it's going to be sunlight. So you've got no exposure meter. You've got to manually set the shutter speed, the aperture setting, the focus ring has to be adjusted manually, and there were little wings put onto them so you could move it with your armored gauntlets. The shutter button was not visible from inside a spacesuit, and you didn't know if you'd taken a photograph. With those limitations of use, some of the most iconic photographs of the 20th century were produced. I think not. I think the photographs that we have seen produced by NASA as evidence for the landing on the moon were professionally taken in simulation and training exercise sets on Earth by professional photographers to produce the PR images that NASA subsequently issued to the world as evidence for the success of the Apollo mission.
All right, that is a possibility that they did take those pictures and give them in addition to it. Let me ask you one question. There's a picture out there that shows the reflection of, and I think it was a picture of Armstrong that Aldrin took, that shows a picture of the lander reflecting in his visor. But it also looks like, to me, it could be a reflection of a photographer standing in front of him that you could see in his visor. In your opinion, is that a real picture, or did somebody somehow superimpose a little tiny picture of a photographer in his suit, not spacesuit, I mean just normal clothes, obviously on a set? Is that possible?
It's possible, but if you're going to produce photographs that are supposedly taken on the moon, you're going to make quite sure that you've got everything absolutely correct. So
how could you make a mistake and get that one out into the system?
Well, exactly. Now, obviously, with the internet and the amount of
computer graphics
software, you know, Photoshop, I've seen photographs showing about 3 astronauts on the moon. Because it's very easy to manipulate the images. So the only images that I use are the ones that that were available up to 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't use any images that were taken off the internet because they can be manipulated. Now, obviously, if you can manipulate them so easily, NASA may well have done so, but manipulated them to make us believe that what we're looking at was what we'd expect to see on the moon. But because only 12 people have ever been onto the moon, so we're told, those are the 12 people who one would have to ask and say, did you take this on the moon? And if you ask them, which I've done, they will say yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, Edgar Mitchell's been on this program before, Apollo 14 astronaut.
He
said he's been there, and he comes across to me as a very sincere, honest person, Marcus.
They all are. They are admirable. All astronauts are admirable men. They're the best of the best. That's why they were chosen. They were trained within an inch of their lives to be the best and to take the American people's dreams and hopes to the moon. That's their purpose. But you have to say one thing. They were all military men.
True.
Every single one of them.
Yes.
They'd all taken their oaths of honor and secrecy, not only to each other, but to their country and to their commander-in-chief. So when their commander-in-chief says, jump, they only have one question. How high, sir?
Well, I think by this time, one of them would have come forward and said, we didn't go. See, that's my point here. Throughout this entire episode over the years, and you talk about there are whistleblowers, but there are no names, there are no places, and not one truly has said, hey, my name is John Smith, and I was in the control room, and I saw the guy back running some film that we picked up and put up on the monitors. We're not getting any of that.
No, that is quite true. We're not getting that because that is what people would like to see, and that is what, if you like, that is the one thing that is missing on this.
Could this have been done, if it's a hoax, could this have been done with the knowledge of a few people, and that even the people in the control room thought they were actually on the moon?
Yeah. My view is that at the very most, 50 people might have had knowledge of a manipulation. The 400,000 people who worked on Apollo had no knowledge of this because they had no need to have that knowledge. At some point, a decision would have been made. Because, don't forget, the original promise was that the landing on the moon would be live on television. Now, if there was the slightest doubt that one of the astronauts would become ill, maybe as a result of radiation-induced sickness, because the first indication of radiation poisoning is vomiting, if there would have been the slightest doubt that any astronaut would have been anything other than 100% fit during the whole mission, would America have risked an astronaut throwing up in his helmet on the moon? I think not. So there would have been a decision made at some point, and I think that decision was made around 1966, 1967. We're going to have to be very careful on this one. We're going to have to ensure that what we have promised, we can deliver. And what was promised was live coverage of the lunar landings. What was delivered was live coverage of the lunar landings, we were told. The more you examine it, the more you realize that the detail is where the errors start creeping in. And on certain occasions, they were a little over-enthusiastic about the detail. Now, if you recall on Apollo 14, this was the...
Mitchell's flight.
That's Mitchell's flight with Al Shepard. They did the famous golf shot.
Right.
Alan Shepard, a very keen golfer, had taken a golf ball onto the moon, mm-hmm. and I believe it was, we're told it was a 6-iron.
Right, and Mitchell had the camera, right?
And Mitchell had the camera. And after they'd done their required experiments, they said, we're going to try a golf shot. And he swung at it and missed the first time and hit it the second time. And he said, oh, there it goes, miles and miles and miles, which is what you'd expect.
Right.
And there's a photograph of this particular event, the golf shot, that was in the Kennedy Space Center for several years. I'm sure many people have seen it. A big blow-up of this photograph. And the photograph showed the lander, the flag, the antenna for communication with Earth. It showed Al Shepard with a golf club, and the golf ball was in midair, and Ed Mitchell. And they're all in the same photograph.
How could he be in it if he was taking the picture?
Exactly. That was my question.
Unless, did he put it up on a tripod?
No, he didn't have a tripod, and the Hasselblad cameras don't have a delayed action shutter facility.
Ah.
So, the obvious explanation is, it's a still from the video. No, it's not, because the video still, which exists, of that particular event, shows a different scene to this one. The point is that the photograph, and I'm saying it's a photograph, it's not a video still, because in every lunar photograph, there are what's called the crosshairs, the reticules, little crosses on the photograph, which was part of the camera. So every mm-hmm. photograph has them. There are 25 on each image. And these appear in this photograph of Alan Shepard doing the golf shot. It's a composite photograph. And once you examine it closely enough, you can see the other four, the other five photographs from which it was derived. It's a fake. But it was presented as a genuine photograph taken on the moon of Alan Shepard and the golf shot. It's a fake. And NASA actually admit this now.
Tell me about the American flag photograph.
The American flag. There's a great deal of nonsense talked about these famous flags that flap in the wind. They don't flap in the wind.
There is no wind there.
There is no wind on the moon, and nobody left one of the studio doors open either. It's a fabrication. It's a good headline statement. Oh, the flag's moving, but it can't.
Well, now here's another question, though, Forrest Marcus. Why would these photographs be given out with all these apparent glares and mistakes?
At the time, nobody had spotted these. It was only literally 25 years after the event, 25 years, that the people were able to sit down, examine them without the emotion of the event. If you recall at the time, there was a lot of emotion around about it. It was a very special time. People didn't want to believe that what they were being shown and what they were looking at were in some way manipulated. They didn't want to believe that. But it was 20, 25 years later that people were able to sit down, examine them, and say, okay, now these are the conditions under which we're told these photographs were taken. On the lunar surface, there is extreme temperatures. There's no pressure. It's a vacuum. These are the cameras that we're told that were taking the photographs. These are the results of the photographs. These are the images. And they don't add up. The detail and the sheer professionalism of the photograph. They are brilliant photographs. As a photographer myself, I would be proud to take those photographs. They're correctly exposed with no exposure meter. They're accurately focused with armored gauntlets. They're well composed with no viewfinder, with no heads cut off. You try taking a photograph without looking through the viewfinder and see how many heads you cut off of taking a picture of somebody. It's actually quite difficult. They also took a lot of panoramic photographs, long, big 180-degree scenes, and all of them overlap. That's almost impossible to do without a viewfinder to see where the camera's pointed. There are very few dud photographs. Yes, of course there are some. But if you look at the Apollo 11 photographs, it's called the famous sequence, it's on the NASA website, nasa.gov.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Magazine 40. Magazine 40 was the actual magazine on the back of the Hasselblad. They took about 120 photographs in each magazine. It's a big magazine. Magazine 40 contains the 120 photographs taken on the Apollo 11 moonwalk. every single one of them is on the NASA website. Not one of them is badly taken, wrongly focused.
All right, I see what you mean. We'll be back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Marcus, why didn't the Russians ever blow the lid on this? Surely they would have jumped up and down if they had felt that this was a hoax.
Absolutely. Of course they would. It's, again, that's probably the number two question. Why didn't the Russians blow the whistle? Because it would have been to their advantage to do so, wouldn't it?
I think so, yeah.
If they could show America up, wow, yeah, go for it. Okay. It's necessary to look at what was happening in Russia around the same time. This is 1969. Because Russia had the same information as we all did as to what Apollo were doing, because it was live on television. In Russia, the space program, or the Soviet space program, had been driven by one man, Sergei Korolev, he was called. He was known at the time as the chief designer. And he was the man, he was a brilliant man, almost as brilliant as Wernher von Braun was in America, who was the architect of the American space program. Sergei Korolev had created all the initial Russian successes. In early 1967, he was admitted to hospital for a minor operation. Regrettably, he died on the operating table, which left the Russian space program without a leader. And there were a lot of people at that time vying for leadership, and the whole Russian space program, if you look at the evidence of it, basically stalled at that time, from 1967 onwards. There was very little success going on. Some of the rockets blew up, and there wasn't a great deal of success. By 1969, America had started to pull well ahead. The big Saturn V rockets were very successful. They were working well. They were demonstrating to the Russians that they basically had a bit of a challenge on their hands. Now, America lands on the moon, July 1969. Why didn't the Russians blow the whistle? Because if they could say, as we do now, we think there's something wrong here. Okay, now the question to ask is, who in Russia would have blown the whistle? You would need a degree of technical information.
True.
Which a lot of people in Russia would have had, because they were attempting to reach the moon as well. They had made the statement. They'd even built some of the spacecraft to go to the moon. And just as an aside on that one, the Russians had publicly announced that they were not intending to send any cosmonauts to the moon until, quote, they could ensure their protection from the dangers of radiation, unquote. And because they couldn't ensure their protection from the dangers of radiation, they hadn't sent anybody to the moon up till that point. Okay, so in Russia, somebody notices the same things we're noticing now. In order to blow the whistle, it would be necessary to persuade the Russian or the Soviet president, Brezhnev, at the time, to make the announcement. But who had access with the knowledge, the technical knowledge, that the Americans had possibly manipulated the reports of the landing? Who would have had the political access to the Politburo of the time, as well as the technical information to do so? And I contend that there was nobody with the necessary lobbying ability to do so. The Russian system of government is very different from the democracies of the West at the time.
But you're saying then that they didn't have the kind of information they needed to go public with this.
They would almost certainly have had the same information as everybody, say, in Britain or in Europe would have had, as well as America. But they wouldn't have had the political access and the political persuasiveness to ensure that an announcement could be made by the Russian president. A better question would be, why did nobody in the West blow the whistle? Why did no photographer come forward?
Well, and to this day, they have not.
Well, I have asked many professional photographers. I've asked them one question. I said, I'm giving you a roll of film with 100 exposures on it. I'm giving you a camera that has no exposure meter, no viewfinder. You've got to wear heavy-duty gardening gloves to operate it. How many of those 100 photographs could you ensure were correctly exposed, correctly composed, accurately focused? Their answer is normally I would say 50-60%. I say, could you do 100%? Absolutely not. So the challenge is, who could produce 100% accurately focused, composed, and exposed photographs under those conditions?
Probably nobody under those conditions.
But that is what we're being asked to believe the Apollo astronauts achieved.
Is that now, why you brought up that magazine 40?
Sorry?
Is that why you were bringing up magazine 40 before the break?
Yes. Magazine 40 is the series of photographs taken primarily by Buzz Aldrin of Neil Armstrong on the moon. The other question is, can anybody produce a photograph of Neil Armstrong on the moon? And the answer is no. There is no photograph of Neil Armstrong on the moon. They both had cameras. They were both issued with cameras. But only one camera was used. That's why there's only one magazine of photographs showing the astronauts on the Apollo 11 lunar mission.
There's no photograph of Neil Armstrong on the moon? Nowhere?
Have you ever seen one?
Well, I can't remember if I did or not, to tell you the truth.
Can anybody point to a photograph of Neil Armstrong? There is supposed to be one showing his back when Buzz Aldrin was taking one of these famous panoramas, and they catch Neil Armstrong in the middle distance, or quite a long way in the distance, but it's only the back view. There's no way you can actually tell if it's Neil Armstrong or not without a fair amount of deduction. So there is a bit of a mystery as to the first man on the moon. There's no photograph of him. No photograph of Neil Armstrong on the moon. And I believe I'm correct in saying
that
Neil Armstrong has never given an interview.
Well, he may have given a few lately, but not a lot about the moon landing.
That's
for
right.
Sure.
And one other point, if I could go back to that piece that you introduced the show with, at the top of the show,
the
famous commentary of the landing of Apollo 11.
Right.
What's wrong with it? What is wrong with that particular, or what is questionable
I do not hear rocket engine sounds.
Correct.
From the inside.
The point is, you can hear their voices very clearly.
Yes. You should at least hear the roar of that engine, because you're talking about thousands of pounds of thrust, right?
That's right. 10,000 pounds of thrust. The same power as a Harrier jump jet.
So why can't we hear anything?
Well, exactly. Now, the obvious answer to that is, well, they're wearing their spacesuits, and you wouldn't hear anything if they're wearing their spacesuits. Well, that's a logical answer. But you have to, again, look at the detail of it. They were standing inside the lunar lander. Not sitting, they were standing, both of them, side by side, Aldrin and Armstrong. And the voice you hear is primarily of Aldrin reading out the figures of how fast the craft was descending and how far across the surface it was moving. So many feet down, so many feet across. That's the figures, and that's the voice. And Armstrong, as we know, had taken over manual control of the spacecraft because the computer had shown a 1201 warning, which indicated the computer overload. So he'd taken over manual control. So he was operating the craft himself. And part of the controls are a computer keyboard, fairly small switches and dials, which he had to operate, as well as the joystick-type control to manipulate the engines.
Mm-hmm.
And we're being asked to believe that he's doing all this while wearing his spacesuit. Now, you can't wear half a spacesuit. You've got to wear the whole thing, gloves and all. Would you wear heavy-duty gardening gloves to operate the computer keyboard if your life depended on it, which his did at this point? I think not. You would probably try to operate it with your hands unencumbered.
If you could, I mean...
If you could.
Yeah.
So if he was doing that, which is the logical explanation for what was occurring, that he was not wearing his spacesuit, then the cabin of the lunar lander had to have been pressurized with an atmosphere so that he could breathe.
True.
And the pressure would have been about 5 pounds per square inch, which is what they used in space. But if it was pressurized, there was an atmosphere, and sound travels in an atmosphere. And the rocket that was firing to slow the craft down to land on the surface was just below his feet. And rockets, as we know, when they fire, make an awful lot of noise and vibration. And some of that, I contend, would have been audible on that tape, which either indicates he was wearing a spacesuit, in which case how do you operate it with your armored gauntlets, or he wasn't, in which case how can he hear it in the first place? So there is a major question about that very famous sequence of the landing of Apollo 11.
I'll tell you the one thing that puzzles me, Marcus, over and above everything, is that when Kennedy made that challenge, we got there within 8 years, right?
That's right. Eight years, correct.
Bush wants to go back to the moon. Now, keep in mind, we went to the moon with technology that is 40 years old today. So whatever the technology was 40 years ago, it surely isn't what it was like today. So Bush makes an announcement that we should go back to the moon, but it's not going to be for 20 years. And I'm saying to myself, now we've, one, already been there. Two, we've been there with really old technology. The technology now is so good, why do we have to wait 20 years? That I don't understand. We should be able to theoretically get there in 3 years, 5 years, maybe.
I'm with you on this. I'm right there.
I mean, we got a blueprint for how to get there. We know what it takes. The rocketry is available. I mean, the technology is around. It's better. Why do we have to wait 20 years? So when he said that, I will say for the very first time, it puzzled me because I didn't understand that.
Yeah, it puzzled a lot of people.
It can't be money. No. To me, it was, do we not have the technology to get to the moon? That's the only time I've ever questioned it. And I still believe, and I'll say it again, we've been to the moon, but that one puzzled me.
Well, I'm definitely with you on that one, because I was waiting for the announcement that President Bush made, because it had been trailed beforehand that he was going to make an announcement about space. This was, what, a year or so ago?
Yeah.
And I thought, great, you know, America going back to the moon. Now we can get the truth about Apollo. Because, believe me, the first time anybody goes back to the moon, the first thing they're going to do is a bit of sightseeing.
Absolutely.
Hey, let's go and look at those Apollo sites.
Yep.
You know, there's six of them. There's got to be one here somewhere. Come on, guys, let's go and have a look.
Sure.
What's it like? First thing they're going to do, oh, whoops, NASA, Houston, you've got a problem. There's nothing here. Now, if that's the situation, maybe this is why Bush is trying to push it back further and further, so that all the people around today who might be in a position to question it will have been maybe gone to join the great spacecraft in the sky, and we can look down and have a bit of a giggle.
Well, interesting point.
But you're quite right to say that how come it's going to take twice as long to get back to the moon as it did to get there in the first place?
With older technology.
We're told that the computing power on the lunar lander was no greater than your average desktop calculator is today. It didn't need a great deal of computing power, possibly. It only needed to crunch a few numbers. But if you look at the ability to make the craft, to test them, and to do it, we have all that now. There's a very interesting announcement which relates to this by the then head of NASA, Sean O'Keefe, who's recently tendered his resignation.
Correct, yeah.
He made an announcement about 2 years ago when he was appointed, and he said, during my tenure as director of NASA, I will have two major objectives that we intend to reach. One is the development of advanced propulsion systems for deep space travel, and the second is research into the protection of astronauts from the dangers of radiation in space. Hello? Hadn't they solved that on Apollo? The astronauts were up there on Apollo 17. They were out in space for 12 days. Why do we now need to do the research to find out how to protect them? Go and ask Ed Mitchell. He knows. He was there. Wouldn't that be a reasonable answer?
True.
Now, I thought, okay, these spacesuits the guys used, they must have been particularly good at protecting them from radiation. So I contacted the manufacturers of the spacesuits, a company called Hamilton Standard in Connecticut, and said, these spacesuits that you make for the Apollo astronauts, they still make spacesuits for NASA today, these spacesuits you made for the Apollo astronauts, because they obviously protected the astronauts from the radiation levels in space, because all the astronauts went to the moon and came back again, they're all still alive, or they were when it made the question. Could these same spacesuits be used by technicians to go into Chernobyl or Three Mile Island nuclear reactors and clean up the mess? No, they said. Why? I said. because there is no protection from radiation built into those spacesuits. Why, I said, you must direct your questions to NASA. We built it to their specification. So I asked NASA, guess what? No reply.
Nothing.
So the question remains, if these spacesuits are so good at protecting astronauts from the radiation levels of space, which are similar, but not identical to, but similar to the radiation levels generated by the sun in deep space beyond the Van Allen radiation belts, why can't they be used by technicians to go into a nuclear reactor?
All right, what about this? What about the moon rocks? We've got 800-plus pounds of moon rock.
Yep, 840 pounds of moon rocks.
So are you saying this stuff's not from the moon?
I'm not saying it's not from the moon. I'm just saying, did the 12 named Apollo astronauts actually collect it all from the moon?
Are you saying it could have been done robotically?
I'm saying it could have been done robotically, and it was done robotically by the Russians. They did exactly that. They didn't bring a lot of... They brought 300 grams of surface material back. They sent a robotic craft to the moon. It landed. It scooped up a few grams of... in fact, it was about half a pound. 300 grams, about half a pound of surface material, and brought it back to Earth.
Well, what about this 840 pounds you just mentioned?
Okay, that is what we're told the six Apollo missions that landed brought back with them. Now, that 840 pounds, I've seen the sample of moon rock, which is on display in our Science Museum here in London. It's a small thing, about the size of a half brick. Not particularly big, and it's in a very nice display case, and it has a big sign on it saying moon rock. So who am I to doubt the Science Museum's description? They never get things wrong. Don't mention the Piltdown Man. Now, that's maybe a little bit cynical. We also know that Wernher von Braun, accompanied by several NASA scientists, visited Antarctica in 1967. What was he doing in Antarctica in 1967? Fast forward to 1996, when then-President Clinton makes an announcement about the discovery of fossilized bacteria in a rock from Mars. Well, we know that nobody's been to Mars to collect rocks and bring them back.
True.
This rock is known by its number, ALH0084, which stands for Allen Hills, 1984, when it was discovered. Allen Hills is an area in Antarctica where a lot of meteorite material is recovered. No secret about that. It was only the examination of this rock which identified possible fossilized bacteria. So we know that rocks can land in Antarctica, having been dislodged from Mars, presumably by meteorite impact. The same thing can presumably happen on the moon. Now, what we're seeing, or what we're told of the 840 pounds of moon rock, 600 pounds of that total is still locked in the vaults at Houston. It has never seen the light of day. So we only have to take NASA's word for it. NASA, which possibly stands for Never a Straight Answer, wouldn't necessarily be the best people to convince us that we're being told the truth. Some of the rock has been distributed to scientific establishments, universities, research laboratories around the world. How many people have read the reports of the research that was done? Well, I have. Now, the interesting point that most people come to is when you talk about moon rocks, everybody imagines things, you know, pebbles, lumps of rock.
Yeah, a little things, something you grab with your hand.
Yeah, something you grab with your hand, sort of fistfuls of rock. The research was done on a few grams of material that had been ground up, put into a box, labeled moon rock, and sent to these laboratories.
Marcus, stay with us. Stay with us. Go ahead, finish real quick. I got 10 seconds. Can you do it?
How do we know they were examining rocks brought back by Apollo and not from Antarctica?
Let's come back with phone calls at the halfway point next hour. We'll have our fast blast poll as well. We're with our guest Marcus Allen, who's out there in the United Kingdom, where it's probably about, what, 5, 6 o'clock now out there now, Marcus?
Yeah, about 9 o'clock in the morning over here. Yeah, we're about 8 hours ahead of you, I think.
Oh, that's right. When I'm in St. Louis, you're only about 6 hours ahead.
Six hours.
But now I'm in Los Angeles right now, so that's that. I got to remember where I am time wise sometimes. So before we go to the calls, and a little bit later on this hour, we'll take a poll because I want you to get a perceptive feeling on how our many listeners have reacted to all of this tonight.
I'll be very interested in that. Look forward to that.
So my take is you haven't said this yet, whether you believe we've been to the moon or not. I mean, you've talked about whether you believe the authenticity of some of these photographs is real or not, but you haven't said yes or no. So I'm going to pin you down on this.
Right. I would say that the 12 named Apollo astronauts we're told landed on the moon didn't.
Did not. Hmm.
Did not. Not the named astronauts.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, we're told Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Ed Mitchell, Al Shepard. These are the named Apollo astronauts.
Right.
And we know who they are. They've been interviewed. They've been on television. They're heroes. They are famous people. This was part of the whole Apollo program, was to personalize it by ensuring that we knew who these people were. I find it very difficult now to name any of the shuttle astronauts,
True. For
instance.
No, you're right about that.
Michael Foal, I believe, is a British astronaut.
Yep. I just interviewed him a few months ago when he was up there in the International Space Station.
Yeah, no, actually... He was partly responsible for a very interesting experiment that was conducted on the space shuttle, because there's one area that we've not covered yet, which is to do with temperature, the temperature of space. So if I say, what is the temperature of space?
I would say it's pretty darn cold.
It's pretty darn cold, yeah. Well, technically, space doesn't have a temperature, because there's nothing in space to have one. And only matter can have temperature. If you put an object in space, like a spacecraft, yes, that will have a temperature. So if you put an astronaut, or if you put a spaceship into space, what is its temperature? Now, obviously, you can't have a very, very cold spaceship, because no astronaut could survive it. So it has to have a heater, obviously. And the most effective heater is the sun. But space is a vacuum, and vacuum, we know, is the best form of insulation there is. So it gets heated by the radiant energy of the sun. Like, go out into the sun on a sunny day, and it's hot. And that is the radiant energy of the sun. You go out to the same place at night, and it's cold, because there's no energy from the sun to heat it. So in space, you get much more extreme version of that. And Michael Foal was on the space shuttle. This was... the late 1980s, I believe it was, and he was, as all the shuttle astronauts were at the time, complaining of when they were out in space doing their experiments outside the space shuttle, how cold it got when the space shuttle went into the shadow of the Earth. And NASA wanted to know what the temperature variation was. You'd think they'd have worked it out by then, but no, they were asked to do some experiments to establish the temperature outside the space shuttle, as it went into the shadow of the Earth and as it came out of the shadow of the Earth, i.e. into the sun. When it was in the shadow of the Earth, i.e. in the darkness, the temperature went down to about minus 165 Fahrenheit, which is cold. That's very, very cold.
Absolutely.
Indeed. So cold that, in fact, they started to get frostbite inside their gloves, and that was the point they were raising. They wanted heated gloves to ensure that when they worked in the shadow of the Earth outside the space shuttle, they didn't get very, very cold hands and so get frostbite. As they come round the shadow of the Earth into the sunlight again, the temperature climbs to plus 200 Fahrenheit, quote, within a few minutes, unquote, i.e. very, very fast indeed. Now, 200 Fahrenheit is just below the boiling point of water.
A little too hot for a human being, I think.
Yeah, you need to have... That's why you have a spacesuit and you can control the atmosphere inside it with the backpack. The point I'm making is that we have an enormous temperature variation here, and it's quite fast. So if you are on the moon in your lunar lander, you're sitting in full sunlight all the time, because They were told they only landed on the moon when it was in the sunlit
rather than
the far side, which at certain times half the moon is in sunlight, half the moon is in darkness. If you're sitting in the moon, sitting on the moon in your spacecraft, will it be hot or will it be cold? Now, the reports from Apollo 11 stated that Buzz Aldrin had real trouble getting to sleep because it was so cold. Okay? When the Skylab was put up a few years after Apollo, 1973, it had to have heat shields to protect it. And these were in the form of some of a sort of curtain material that was put over the craft to keep the temperature down. And if you recall at the time, some of them got badly damaged during the deployment, and they weren't very effective. And the temperature inside the Skylab started to climb to over 200 degrees. So, hang on a minute, we've got two reports here, one in Earth orbit where the temperature appears to climb very high, and one on the moon where there is no shadow, where the temperature is very cold. It doesn't make sense. There is no logical explanation. Because if you get into your car when it's been parked in the sun, in hot sun for a few hours, the inside of the car is almost too hot to touch.
If I could get, I want to go to some calls here, Marcus, but if I could get a couple astronauts on this program, would you come back on with me?
I'd be delighted. I'd really be delighted.
And because, I mean, you're bringing up some technical questions, which are good ones, which I obviously can't answer, and you might as well get it from the horse's mouth and ask them about the temperature variance and things like that.
I would be delighted, and I promise I will be very polite.
Well, I know you are. I can tell just by who you are that you're that kind of person. Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, and good evening. I was wanting to ask you, gentlemen, if you knew about a Science Journal show some decades ago about the brain drain, where they ended up with interviewing one of the astronauts who said that the Apollo mission was a cover for a plan to re-inhabit Mars by terraforming Mars, and they had bases on the dark side of the moon. And further to that, the temperature of the film, wouldn't it, the film shatter or melt because the cameras weren't insulated, and there's no ascent smoke from the liftoff engine. Would that engine burning fuel not leave a plume of some sort?
That's a very good point. Very good. In fact, there's 2 points on this one. The show you're referring to was called Alternative 3.
Yes, right.
And it was shown, and it was actually what we would call today a drama documentary.
Okay.
It was shown in the mid-1970s in Britain. It created quite a stir, almost as big a stir as the Da Vinci Code is causing at the moment. It was fiction. The author of the follow-up book, Leslie Watkins, who now lives in New Zealand, stated quite categorically that he had written the show based on fact, but as a fictionalized version. It was a drama, and a very good one, too. And there was an astronaut interviewed in it. I think his name was Dave Grodin or something similar to that. If you watch the show, at the end of the show, the cast list was shown, as after all dramas, a cast list is shown. They were actors. The whole thing was a dramatized version of events. Now, one of the things shown was the terraforming of Mars. This is in the mid-1970s, and there was alleged film of this terraforming. Alternative 3, just so that one understands exactly what it is, there was an Alternative 1 and Alternative 2. It's based on global warming. If global warming is going to make this planet uninhabitable, it was necessary to start having some alternatives. Alternative 1 involved exploding a nuclear bomb in the upper atmosphere to blow a hole and let the heat out. This actually did happen. Nuclear explosions did take place in the upper atmosphere over Johnson Island in the Pacific and by the Russians over Siberia. And we now know, obviously, that that's not something that is going to work particularly well. Alternative two was the construction of underground bases and tunnels in order that the elite, whoever they may be, could live safely under the surface of the Earth and continue to survive when the surface got uninhabitable. We know that there are such things as underground bases at Cheyenne Mountain Certain areas of Nevada have big underground bases, but they couldn't build them fast enough to hold enough people. So alternative three was the terraforming of Mars to create a new habitable planet for the human race to emigrate to when this planet became uninhabitable. And on the way, the moon was to be used as a staging post, and that is where all the scientists were supposed to be going.
Because
the program was to do with the missing scientists.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
I tried to find that book. It took me several months to locate, and it said on it, I guess it said political theory or something like that. And then there was a republication where it said fiction. But the other one was more like a political analysis thing, almost like they were picking up clues here and there. Is there any chance that the disinformation people might be leaking something to see if they could turn it into fiction so that people wouldn't believe it if it was true?
It was based on a great deal of research that there were three authors of the book. The main author and the main writer was a guy called Leslie Watkins, and he did have a great deal of information, and some of it was quite accurate. What he said at the time, following the fairly large row that followed, I mean, questions were asked in the British House of Parliament about this. That's how convinced people were. He said, "I was surprised how close we got." And a lot of people felt that he got far too close and that he must have access to secret information. Now, whether he did or not, I don't know. All I do know is that the information he presented in nearly 30 years ago has turned out in many cases to be remarkably accurate in his speculation, which he admitted that he did at the time.
Okay, thank you for that call. Let's move on now to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Marcus, I thought I was going crazy because I tell people about this theory about the photographs, and everyone look at me kind of crazy, and so I avoided bringing it up, particularly at dinners. But I found some data on the NASA website. They have to publish all of their catalogs because it was paid for with public money. The lunar mission was 19 hours long. They shot 90 minutes of motion footage, and they have cataloged 2,068 frames of photographs. Now, I used to work as a photographer, an architectural photographer. I wasn't wearing garden gloves or gauntlets, as you called them. But I would be lucky if I could shoot off 100 good photographs in one day. I mean, 100 frames, not 100 good photographs, 100 frames. And these guys, in their suits, were shooting off 2,068 frames. A good percentage, at least 1,500 of those, were 70 millimeter. I did some calculations with, I didn't know about the special camera back that the that Hasselblad designed, but just the weight of the film plus the backs necessary, if there were standard backs, would weigh about 70 pounds. And this is a mission, of course, where they had to go down to the lunar surface with two men because they couldn't carry the third man. You know, they're carrying back, you know, 100 pounds of rocks. You know, I guess I'm expecting either that they got really good at changing film while they were in their suits. They'd have to go back into the ship every time they needed to change film. Anyway, kind of interesting theory. I've seen a few cases where people have taken these photographs and said, you know, those crosshairs, oh, look, there's a missing crosshair. So I actually found some of those photographs. They're available through NASA, and I think that's a debunkable myth. Those photographs actually do have crosshairs. Diffraction of light causes them to fade out, but if you do a histogram on the region where you expect to find the crosshair, you can actually bring it back in the photograph where it seems to have disappeared, where an object seems to be in front of the crosshair. It's actually still there. But I was wondering, I can't get any more data than just the sheer number of photographs, but have you actually gone through the catalogs? First of all, I think my numbers are correct because that's actually published by NASA. It's almost a human impossibility that they could have taken so many photographs. Your comment, I guess I have one comment. I'll make that first, and that is it sounds like somebody overshot in the studio and they went through the government photo processing agency, I think it's called Niagara, and the things accidentally got cataloged, because there's no way they could have, I mean, if they're really going to pull this off, they should have been a lot more tight-lipped about the number of photographs and things like that. It almost sounds like a kind of human error, like they send, you know, their best boy down to get the photos developed, and he accidentally catalogs them all or something like that. Any comments on that?
It is certainly true that there were a great deal of a great many. I think the figure is 32,000 photographs were taken by the Apollo astronauts, both in the orbiting command and service module as the third astronaut and the two on the surface. And over six missions, given the number of days they spent on the surface, this is probably not an unrealistic figure. The magazine that was used on the Hasselblad camera, it's the 100 exposure magazine. It's about the size of the camera itself. The normal 12 exposure or 24 exposure magazine is a bit smaller. It's about 1 inch across or 1 inch deep. The 100 exposure magazine is about 3 inches. I'm not quite sure where you get the figure of 70 kilos from for the camera. The Hasselblad camera, I've actually borrowed or been lent an example of the Lunar Hasselblad camera from Hasselblad UK over in London. They're quite willing to lend it to people because they're very proud of it. It is a heavy piece of kit, and Hasselblads are not the easiest cameras to use. They're designed for tripod use and studio use, but their lenses are exceptional quality and made by Zeiss. And this is why the camera was chosen. The major point about the numbers is, if we assume that my theory that the photographs were taken by professional photographers on Earth during the training and simulation exercises, and these were substituted for what we're told the astronauts took on the lunar surface, then the numbers are really irrelevant, because a professional photographer doesn't really care how many films he shoots. He will probably shoot as many films as he possibly
can.
Sure,
all he wants is that one good picture.
He wants the one good picture. Now, most professional photographers, when you ask them, say, how can you guarantee to get a good picture? They'll say, I'll bracket it. Bracket it means that you will shoot the same image using slightly different exposures, slightly over, slightly under, what you hope is the right one, so that with slide material, which is what these photographs were originally shot on, they were not negative material, they were slide, they were positive material, and you can't adjust the exposure, you can't adjust the development of them.
All right, stay with us, Marcus. Marcus James Oberg, whom I know, he's been on the show, had been commissioned by NASA to write a book refuting the stories that they faked the landing, and then they canceled it abruptly. James may or may not on his own write his own book about this, but why did NASA cancel it?
I think it was purely from the point of view of, why should we have to prove something that we know happened? That was their attitude. They also got a fair bit of political heat. Why should NASA have to spend money that is obviously authorized through budgets in Congress? Why should NASA have to pay money to pay somebody to do something which shouldn't have to happen in the first place?
Let's go back. Well, go ahead.
Though I believe that James Oberg did receive compensation for the time he'd already spent doing the research. I'd been in contact with him myself about it, giving him some pointers, which I hope might enable him to make an accurate deduction, but he still seems to be persuaded that they landed. But that's his prerogative to have that opinion. One point I would make, many people will criticize this idea that something as iconic as Apollo could possibly have been manipulated. Most of those people who tend to do that are astronomers and space scientists. They're not photographers. But the evidence that everybody looks at to try to establish whether what they're looking at is true or not are the photographs and the films. So we do have a bit of an anomaly here that obviously astronomers, whose opinion I would respect as regards astronomy, I hope would equally regard my opinion as a photographer. They may not understand the detail and the technicalities of photography, but you do need to have that information to be able to make the judgments.
Okay, now we go to the phones. You ready? Boy, this program has gone by rocket fast with you, talking about taking off. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you doing this evening?
Good.
I just wanted to make a few comments as quickly as I can. I'm formerly worked for NASA in the early 60s, and I wasn't in NASA during the Apollo program, but I do know some of the astronauts and a number of the people that worked with it, and I was in the communications end of it. There is no way that the Apollo missions, as far as sending the rockets to the moon, the landing on the moon, could not have been and would not have been detected by any foreign governments, Russia, Britain, Australia, China. We were able to track it as ham radio operators. We could track the equipment. We knew, of course, we knew the frequencies that they were using. We could track them to the moon. We also could track them directly through the NASA net because they were relayed via the deep space network at Goldstone, Madrid, Spain, and Tidbin Villa, Australia. And they are relayed via a geosynchronous satellite to the NASA headquarters and into the Johnson Space Center. It was possible not only to track them, but when Apollo 13 exploded, the fume or the plume of gas was spotted by a number of amateur astronomers at the location where it was supposed to have been. The other comment I'd like to make quickly is these astronauts, a number of those missions were fairly complicated to go through the separation of the vehicles.
I think they all were complicated.
Very complicated. The separation of the vehicles, the separation of the lunar lander, the command service module, is something that would be very difficult to do automatically and do it successfully. Now, suppose we had three astronauts, say Aldrin, Armstrong, Collins, were on the first mission. Suppose they had gone up there, and we're tracking them, and they're in orbit around the moon, and then all of a sudden the whole thing crashes. Now, what are we going to do with those fellows? Take them out and shoot them? I mean, this is getting a little ridiculous. You're in, I think, where these stories got started. Somebody should really look into the background of the people that started some of these stories in the first place and see if they might have another reason for doing it. Maybe not necessarily scientific, and I'm not going to go into any further details on that, but I'm quite certain that we went to the moon. And that basically is, I've enjoyed your program, but this is a question that's been going on for a long time, and if you compare the pictures that were taken photographically with the pictures from the television transmissions, and basically the television transmissions that were good were from the 15, 16, and 17 mission. The earlier ones were a little difficult to interpret. But if you compare the television pictures with those of the photographs, I think you'll find the rocks and the primary locations are essentially the same. You're not going to find much discrepancy in them. And I have complete recordings of all of the transmissions from the television. So I
from,
think
from the television, but
yes.
we don't know if there were others that we just didn't hear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, as I say, if you compare that with the photography taken on the surface, I think you'll find that most of it, while it may be taken from slightly different angles, the material is in the proper position. Now, there was a lunar experimental laboratory set up, I think, down at Johnson, where they had simulators set up, and they set up some simulated rocks and so forth, and they took pictures down there. Some of them are in some of the reports, but these pictures are obvious when you look at them, that these were not taken on the moon, but they were never claimed to be taken on the moon. They were taken when they were running practice simulations. But I think if you compare the pictures that were supposedly taken on the moon with the pictures taken by the television cameras, you'll find that the rocks and other material essentially is in the proper location.
Well, I got to say this, too, and thanks for your call, Marcus, that I'm going to give you this. I still think we went to the moon, and I'm going to open up my poll now, too, because I want you to have results before we're off the air.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
But I do believe they may have sent out some pictures of simulation, and they should have at least disclosed that.
That's
They should have said.
If NASA had said, these are simulated pictures, but this is what it was like on the moon, ask the astronauts, they'll tell you. I don't have a problem with that.
Yep.
But that's not what NASA told us.
Okay, so fast blast me, everyone. All I'm looking for, because we don't have time for your total explanation, did we go to the moon or not? Yes or no? Just fast blast me. We'll have the results for Marcus before we get off the air. Let's go to our next caller. Let's go to our first-time caller. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, good man, George.
Yes,
Smitty
sir.
Here from Coatesville, Pennsylvania.
Hello, Smitty.
I'm with him. I just want to ask your opinion real quick on something. I think the space program is failing the space station. And they always said if you're on the moon, they had enough raw material. If you got there, they could build an actual station and everything else. If that is true, why did they waste all their time building a space station? Just send it right to the moon. And why is China so interested now all of a sudden of going to the moon? You know, they are interested in wanting to go to the moon. Why? It's a good military position, I guess.
It could be strategic. Marcus, why does China want to go?
China, again, why did America want to go in the first place? It's a demonstration of technical ability. China are certainly intending to go. Japan are certainly intending to go. I believe India have an intention to launch at least a satellite to the moon. It's the first major step into space.
20 years.
Well, it could take 20, 30 years, I think, after our lifetime. But this point about did we actually get to the moon or not is a very easy answer to find out, which I would certainly accept.
By the way, Joe, my answer is yes. I think we got there.
Well, I would like to see the...
Okay, I got you.
Okay.
I would like to see the evidence for it. I would like to see the evidence that we got to the moon, independent of NASA. Now, there's one way to do that. There are telescopes, I believe, in Chile called the VLT, Very Large Telescope, which has the ability to photograph an object the size of a lunar lander on the moon's surface. Let's see the photograph, and then I'll shut up. Until I see it, I'm not persuaded.
All right. Next up, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Pleasure to talk to you, George. I want to make four quick points. There's evidence that the astronauts were making transmissions on the way, saying that they were seeing things, objects on the moon, and this was confirmed by an Italian transmission that I read about, where they were saying, we're seeing stuff on the moon, and NASA was telling them, ichne, ichne, you know, don't say anything more. Also, the next point is that there was flags that were waving on the moon. Also, that lunar lander, it seemed impossible to control here on Earth. I don't know why it would work up there. And also, I agree that if they would point Hubble up there, they would be able to see what's going on. So if you could comment on that, I'd be very grateful.
All right. Go ahead, Marcus.
I would certainly agree that somebody, if they were landed on the moon, could have sent us some sort of signal to Earth. Well, you could say that they sent a TV signal or a radio signal. These reports that people intercept the broadcasts and people hear various things, I mean, these are quite persuasive in themselves. But are they necessarily the truth, or are they disinformation? One of the previous callers mentioned this point about tracking Apollo to the moon. If you looked at the size of the receivers that NASA had to use for these, they're 250 foot across. These are huge aerials. Ham radio operators wouldn't stand a chance of being able to pick up anything like that. And where is the recording of any of the information that they supposedly had? I've never heard it. Perhaps they exist, but I've never heard it. And if they're so persuasive that people are recording what's going on the moon, let's hear it. Let's get this out into the open. Believing we landed on the moon is a prerogative anybody can have. But confirming it with hard factual evidence is quite something else.
All right, thank you. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, with the time remaining you're on. Hi there.
Hi there. Good morning, George. And,
good morning to you.
And your guest's name is?
His Marcus. Name is Marcus.
Marcus. Hi, Marcus. Yeah, I'm a ham operator, too. And by the way, you could receive that. But I'm not going to go into that with you. I had one thing that maybe solves your problem for you. You were talking about the fact that the temperature deviation in a vacuum was very extreme, okay? And that they actually, I guess you have the temperatures that they were inside and outside. And the problem was is when you're in the shade, you're very, very cold. And when you're in the sunshine, you said it was something like 200 degrees. Now, and you said when they had landed on the moon that it was less than. In other words, the temperatures variance didn't seem to be the same. Well, I have a way of maybe I could solve the problem for you, possibly, to postulate this one. Remember the waving flag problem? I think you remember that they said, how could you have a waving flag? Well, what if that they didn't say it, but what if the moon actually has an atmosphere that would solve the problem of the temperature deviation and also the problem of the flag waving? What do you think about that?
But, well, if it did have an atmosphere, yes, it would solve both of those problems. But I have seen no credible evidence that the moon has an atmosphere. I don't believe that the size of the moon indicates that it is big enough to retain the atmospheric particles that would be necessary. And given the conditions under which it operates, I'm not sure that it has the ability to do that. It is basically a lump of rock in space that is prone to all the dangers of space, like being hit by meteors or being irradiated from the sun. This idea of the waving flags, I would tend to dismiss that out of hand, because the only time you get the flags apparently moving was when the hand of an astronaut was anywhere near it. I've examined hours of film to try to establish if it's true. I don't see that it is true, any more than you would see stars in the photographs. That is a red herring, that one. It should be dismissed and not even discussed. It's so... It is basically such a stupid idea that the stars would appear in the photographs. They will appear in the sky. That's not a problem. That's not a dispute. But they will not appear in the photographs because the film isn't sensitive enough to record them.
All right, here's our poll. Do you want these results, Marcus? And quite honestly, I'm a little startled by it.
Go on,
tell
me.
60% believe we went to the moon, 40% say no. And that includes about 125 quick fast blasts that are in. So
that's interesting. It's an increase. 40% is an increase on the normal figure.
That's high. I would have thought it might have been like 90-10 or something like that.
Yeah. That's what you'd expect. I've heard 2025 quoted fairly regularly as people who don't believe we went to the moon. But 40, it shows this subject has legs, as they say. It's not going to go away. If 40% of your listeners are persuaded that something needs to be further dealt with on this, I think you're providing a great service.
Well, and of course, as you well know, lots of people at this point in society don't have much faith in government telling them everything.
I would agree with that.
Next,
they don't.
Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. I'm glad to be on the air. Thank you for taking my call.
No problem.
And I've enjoyed the show. I've actually only heard just the last few minutes of it, but I wanted to comment. You can lump me in with that 40% against another thing. But the another thing I wanted to mention was that there was a video that I saw years ago, and I have a copy of it, called "Was It Only a Paper Moon?" And it goes into some of the things that your guest has mentioned, some of the things about the waving flag and the different positioning of shadows and different things like that. And the fact that the dust plumes from the supposed lunar rover vehicle were only going up a certain distance, the same distance as they go in the atmospheric conditions on Earth, which is very unusual. But... Have you ever heard of that video?
Yes, I have. Yep. I'm familiar with that. That does bring some very good points out. Probably the best video on the subject is a video called "What Happened on the Moon." Hmm. That's available through Adventures Unlimited bookshops.
Adventures Unlimited?
AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com would be the contact for them. They sell the video. It's a two-video set, lasts 3.5 hours, so there's a lot of information in it. And that covers that particular subject as well, the dust plumes kicked up by the lunar rovers. If it was happening in an atmosphere, it would react in one way. If it's happening in a vacuum, it would react in a different way, and it appears to be filmed in an atmosphere. But that's a matter of debate. In fact, one of the earlier callers made an interesting point about the takeoff of the lunar lander's rocket as it left the moon. And I'm sure we're familiar with the sequence of the camera panning up to follow it up into the lunar sky.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no dust plume, which is odd. But even more important, there's no heat source because the camera is looking up underneath the craft. And as we know, all rockets produce a heat source. in an atmosphere, they do produce vast plumes. We're all very familiar with rockets taking off on Earth, but we're not quite so familiar with rockets taking off on the Moon. On Earth, there's an atmosphere which contains moisture, which produces steam, and also the exhaust gases from the rocket itself. On the Moon, the lunar lander's rocket was powered by hypergolic fuel. Now, without getting into the technicality of it, this is fuel two chemicals which brought into contact explode. Now, the key point is, this is the same fuel as used on the space shuttle today for the maneuvering.
You should have seen a dramatic plume there.
You do. And when it maneuvers in space, i.e. in a vacuum, you see a bright light, flash of light, i.e. a heat source. On the Moon, there's no heat source.
Well, Marcus, I got to say, you probably convinced more people than I thought you would. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Marcus.
Thank you, George. I really appreciate it, and a very good evening to you.
Marcus Allen, live in the United Kingdom. I still think we went, but maybe they sent out some simulated pictures, and if they did, they should not have.